proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Tom remains in Dubrovnik, Croatia, and he will join you live from there by satellite tomorrow. In the meantime, I'm happy to be subbing for Tom. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco, and I'll be here again on Friday. That's the day Tom will hop on an airplane and return to the United States, and, of course, he'll be back with you all next week here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our toll-free number is 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. You're welcome to call the program, and we'll be taking calls here shortly. On the program today, in about half an hour, Robert Dreyfus, a great investigative journalist, will report on George W. Bush's choice of language and some of the misassumptions the neocons made heading into Iraq. He wrote a piece for the American Prospect called Shia Fella, and that's a remark of verbatim from George W. Bush. And it turns out the word fella in Arabic is not a very nice term for somebody. We'll find out more about that from Robert Dreyfus a little bit later this hour. Coming up in our second hour today, Paul Waldman will join us from Media Matters for America. You may have noticed that when religious people show up on the news, they're often of the extreme right, conservative, evangelical sort. And Media Matters conducted a study that proves just that. Progressive religious voices are largely locked out of our mainstream media. And we're going to talk with a one-man protester. Evan Knappenberger served in Iraq. He is protesting what is variously referred to as the backdoor draft or stop loss. And he has a one-man protest underway in a public place in Bellingham, Washington. We'll hook up with him and find out what his message is. And we'll be taking lots of your calls today, too. So stay by your phone and call in when the urge strikes you, because we did check and the First Amendment is still in full effect. Well, last night, the Republican candidates for president gathered in Manchester, New Hampshire at St. Anselm's College just a couple of days after the Democrats did so. And under a questioning from Wolf Blitzer and a couple of other colleagues there, CNN brought us this group. Cliff Schechter joins us now. He is a political consultant, and also he operates the website, therealmccain.com, and he blogs at cliffschechter.com. Schechter is spelled S-C-H-E-C-T-E-R. And he joins us today from the Green Mountain State. He's in Vermont. Hi, Cliff.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing well today. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, you sound fine. So you were just a mountain range apart from the action in New Hampshire last night. What kind of reaction do you think New Englanders had to the Republican panel and their presentation?
Well, an interesting one. I think it's amazing to me. I think to me one of the signature moments of the debate last night was when Governor Tommy Thompson got up and he said, "I'm so glad that we finally got a question on health care."
Yeah.
Which should tell you everything. I mean, three debates. They've probably talked about abortion, let's say, eight times a debate, gay marriage on, you know, or gays in the military or any other social issues that they're obsessed with, on and on and on. But something is so unimportant as health care, which, you know, only 40 or 50 million people don't have, so no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
They decided they would talk about it once. And I just, you know, actually Tommy Thompson's surprised that he finally got a question that he could talk about something such as so important as that was interesting to me.
Well, and given his limited experience as a cabinet secretary and as a governor of Wisconsin, when Tommy Thompson starts to talk about foreign policy, I cringe. When he wants to talk about something that is in his area of expertise, like health care, even though I don't particularly agree with his proposals, I do respect him and at least will give him a listen.
Right. I feel exactly the same way. It's sort of like the way, as a one-term governor from Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, when he talks about virtually anything, I cringe.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what he actually knows anything about. And I still love how, you know, given to us from on high, I still feel like major media organizations were told who the top candidates are as opposed to people deciding. Because somebody needs to explain to me why Mitt Romney is more qualified to be president than Tommy Thompson, again, a guy who was elected three times by large margins in Wisconsin and was the Secretary of Health and Human Services. You'd think he might have a little more experience for the job.
Yeah. So the lead item on your blog today is Mike Huckabee is dangerous. You write, he won't win the GOP primary, and I think that's good for the Democrats because out of all 10 on that stage, he's the only one that gets it. What is it?
Oh, I completely, you know, that's exactly the way I feel. Because he actually talks like a human being, and he actually is logical, and he takes some of the positions the Republicans have, which should be to their logical end, which never is with them, which, as we know, they care about you a lot when you are an embryo, a little bit more when you're a fetus, and then now that there's 20% of the children in this country don't have health care, no, that's not a concern of theirs. Whereas Mike Huckabee stands up and he is very pro-life. He is, you know, to the point of making me uncomfortable. But to his credit, he makes a point of saying every time how it doesn't end there. You can't be pro-life and then say, okay, the baby's born, now we're done. And started talking to him into a passionate speech about how they have to care about education and child health care and other things that are important to kids, which, you know, he and I could find common ground on. And I think a lot of moderate voters, frankly, could find common ground. So the truth is, I really do think I thought he was the best last night. I thought he was the best in that last debate. I think he's the best spoken of any of them. He explains his positions the best. They're logical. And so, yeah, I do. I would be surprised about him.
I take your point on Huckabee, but toward the end of the debate, an instructor in philosophy at St. Anselm's asked a question about the biggest moral challenge of our time. And Huckabee, who is a reverend, he is an ordained minister, when he started to talk the God talk, wow, I thought I'd flipped over to the 700 Club or something.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, but the truth is as we know, that he could, he's a guy I think can speak in normal to regular people and could tone that down during a general election. It's a Republican primary, and as someone who lived in New York for a while and actually saw Rudy Giuliani as mayor, to hear him saying we've all been given this by God and how uncomfortable he looked saying that made me want to burst out laughing. I don't know when he found God, if it was between his first and second marriage or his second and third marriage. But he hadn't found God yet when I was in New York, I'll tell you that.
Cliff Schechter is with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. He's got a book that was just shipped to the publisher earlier this week, all about John McCain. Is it called The Real McCain?
It's called The Real McCain. That's another one last night. I thought John McCain did a good job. He actually reminded you a little bit of the old McCain last night because he stood up on immigration even when everybody was against it. In fact, a very funny story was from a restaurant he was in earlier that day, Tom Tancredo showed up and sent him, had the waitress send him over a bucket of nachos.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually serious. I'm not kidding. And Tancredo, of course, is a little bit of a nut.
Yes.
On McCain, I'll defend McCain on that, but my book, of course, goes into the fact that on virtually every issue, from abortion to evolution to immigration to foreign policy, you know, there's a guy that said we couldn't even think about trading American blood for Iraqi blood in 1990 during the Gulf War. There's not one thing you'll find that McCain hasn't changed his positions on. And so I think he was good on immigration, but again, on Iraq last night, he showed why he literally on foreign policy cannot be trusted.
Well, and the remark that really struck a nerve with me, Cliff, was when there was a question asked by a woman who had lost her younger brother to the conflict in Iraq. And he stood up, and I thought that he showed some empathy and compassion as he said, I'm going to give you some straight talk. That was a good branding comment from him. But what made me uncomfortable was when he summed up his remarks by saying that it was worth it, that her brother had died for something worthwhile.
Right.
And I think that's highly presumptuous for any candidate to tell a woman who lost her brother and who clearly is grieving over that, that he thinks it was worth it.
Right, well, it's presumptuous for anybody. It's particularly presumptuous for somebody who, you know, has been voting for these bills and supporting the President of the United States virtually lockstep on this war, while we know for a fact from media reports and other reports from that have gotten out of intelligence that they have not gotten them the armor that they needed, that countless lives could have been saved with some of these IEDs that have blown up vehicles there that were not armored in the manner they should be because it hadn't gotten there. The bulletproof vests that we know weren't working properly. In McCain's own case, you know, he said that he made a statement that he got in trouble for a few months ago when he said their lives had been wasted there.
Yeah.
And he said they'd been wasted because the war had been run stupidly. Mm-hmm. Well, now suddenly this guy's sacrifice wasn't a waste because the war was run stupidly. It was honorable. And then again, he also threw that ridiculous talk in that every intelligence person of the intelligence community has said is absolute bunk, which is that these guys are going to follow us home.
Yeah, right.
Honestly, stop with the crap. I mean, it's so utterly ridiculous.
It is. It is hard to take. Cliff Schechter, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us today. Also want to mention that the Republicans last night took the gloves off, and many of them turned on George W. Bush. That can only be an encouraging sign. Cliff Schechter, visit his website, therealmccain.com, or his blog, cliffschechter.com, and look for his book this fall called The Real McCain. Your calls and comments are next, 866-303-2270 on the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins from San Francisco, sitting in again today for Tom. And we're taking your calls toll-free at 866-303-2270. 866-303-2270. There's a live chat room available to you at TomHartman.com, and listeners always try to lure me in there, but I find it too distracting to watch that while I do the show, so forgive me if I don't drop in too, but go to TomHartman.com and click on the live chat. It's entertaining for the people there. And if you want to drop me an email, they've already started to come in, send it to Peter at PeterBCollins.com. Or if you take exception to something I've said, send it to BigMouth@PeterBCollins.com. It will reach me. Last night's Republican GabFest was interesting in that a lot of them dropped their previous sugarcoating of the Bush administration. We heard comments like Duncan Hunter from Southern California saying that the administration has the slows when it comes to building his security fence. Tom Tancredo said that Karl Rove had told him once never to darken the door of the White House. And when asked what assignment he would give George W. Bush in a Tancredo, a Tancredo administration, he said, well, he would return the favor. That was pretty strong language. Very interesting. And so that was one of the differences. Also, there were people like Sam Brownback of Kansas and Duncan Hunter, who both said that they would pardon Scooter Libby if he is still in the pokey when they become president. And the funniest moment was that there was lightning striking during a rainstorm there in New Hampshire, and it wreaked havoc on the wireless microphones. And at one point, when Rudy Giuliani was asked to defend himself from criticism by a Catholic bishop for his alleged pro-abortion stand, pro-choice stand, the lightning interrupted and cut off his remarks. And he responded, well, for a kid who went to parochial school, you got to understand how much that scares me. Let's go to your calls now. And Della is up first from Manhattan. Hello, Della. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter B.
Hello, Peter. I want to talk about McCain's attack on Hillary when he said that she called it Bush's war. But he never called it Clinton's war. When Clinton invaded Serbia, and rightfully so, you know, that war in Serbia was the first imperialistic war of the 21st century. We attacked 19 nations, ganged up on a tiny little nation because Serbia would not sign the Rambouillet Agreement. Of course, it was looked upon as a humanitarian war, but it wasn't really so, because just as many Serbs were killing Albanians as Albanians were killing Serbs, and it is still going on. The killing is still going on. We have NATO forces there keeping the peace, supposedly, but actually it was a gang rape of Serbia. And Hillary Clinton has to be held accountable for that war. He has not been held accountable because that was an attack on a nation that did not attack us. And 19 nations ganged up with all the force in the world and bombed that nation for 45 days. And we needed Russia to come in and negotiate a peace.
Well, Della, I appreciate your point of view. Mine's a little different. I considered the Balkans to be a serious mess and a major humanitarian issue. And I felt that Europe wrung its hands for far too long and turned a blind eye to the situation. And while I don't think that Clinton's policies were perfect there, I do think that his motivation was to end the killing. And I don't, for example, take the side of the Serbs in that dispute. I think they were monstrous, and I think that Milosevic was a very evil guy. So I appreciate your comment. My take is a little bit different. Thanks for your call today. Now to Rich on Long Island. Hello, Rich. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program. Rich, are you there? The long wait on hold can put some people to sleep. Let's try Lynn in NYC. Hello, Lynn in the Big Apple. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program. Good day.
Hi, how you doing?
Just fine, thanks.
You know, I was watching Brownback last night when apparently he was talking about the new plan he was going to come up with for Iraq.
That's right. He wants to partition the nation.
Which sounds very much like Joe Biden's plan, obviously.
I agree.
Right? You're familiar with that, right?
I am, yes.
So, you know, I was thinking, I mean, I've been supporting Biden for a couple of reasons. I don't agree with everything that, you know, that he has done. But when I look at how Democrats can put a candidate forward that's got the most likely chance of success, I see Biden as that guy because, you know, he looks like what Republicans want to see. He's not of a different color or gender than what their favorite flavor of president is.
Yeah.
And he's got the smartest choices amongst us, I think. And he's the most honest and straightforward. And I just, you know, think they would be as much comfortable with him as at least half those guys on the stage.
Well, I'm not opposed to Biden. I have to say that he doesn't excite me, and that his use of the language is often inarticulate. He trips all over himself. Just ask Barack Obama. On the substantive issues, he's a bright man. He is a guy who has paid attention over the years, and he understands the nuances of foreign policy. In particular, in terms of imposing a partition on Iraq, I don't think it's wise for the United States to be the agent for that. If it comes from the Iraqis, I could probably accept it. If it appears to be imposed by the United States, it probably will only compound the problems there. Thanks for your call today, Lynn. I appreciate it. More calls coming up next, and journalist Robert Dreyfus will join us, too. I'm Peter B. Collins. Glad to be sitting in today on the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Thanks for joining us today on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, coast to coast on Air America Radio. From San Francisco, I'm Peter B. Collins. Good to be with you here. Lines open if you'd like to talk with us. Toll free at 866-303-2270. 866-303-2270. Robert Dreyfus is an excellent reporter, a great journalist, and he's got numerous articles in circulation right now. The best place to find his work is at his own website, robertdreyfus.com, DREYFUSS. And I want to talk with Bob about this article that is in the current issue of The American Prospect, headlined, Beware the Shia Fellas. Bob, welcome to the Tom Hartman program today.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
My pleasure. And explain, first of all, what the term fella means in Arabic and how President Bush inadvertently used that term to refer to Abdulaziz al-Hakim, the leader of SCIRI, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq.
Yeah, Bush was meeting with Hakim a couple of years ago. The word fella is Arabic for peasant.
Oh, nice.
And when Bush processed that through his Texas drawl, the word fellow, when he said, oh, I was meeting with this Shia fellow, it came out Shia fella, so he inadvertently insulted the guy that he was meeting with. But the real point of this story here is that, you know, the mess we got into in Iraq didn't just happen. I mean, real people made it happen, and one of the big mistakes we made was believing in, trusting, you know, naively thinking that these religious fundamentalist Shiites who were close to Iran would somehow be our friends in Iraq once Saddam was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it didn't turn out that way.
Indeed, and the people responsible all wrote letters to Judge Walton asking for leniency for Scooter Libby, didn't they?
Yes, well, we don't have any Arabic translators, so we don't know what those letters said.
Uh-huh.
It's one of our problems in Washington. anybody who can speak Arabic is suspect, so we don't get much translated here.
Now, in your article, you described the long-running, what would you call, rivalry between two key families in Iraq, who you tag as the Hatfield and McCoys of that region, the Hakims and the Sadrs. Now, we just talked about Abdulaziz al-Hakim, and most people are aware of the guy who's always referred to as the fiery young cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr. What's the history of their rivalry?
Their fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers, going way back into the mid-20th century and before, were the leading clerical families of Iraq. And under Saddam, the Hakims, which kind of represented the wealthier circles, they fled to Iran and worked with Ayatollah Khomeini, the man who made the Iranian Revolution, and got Iranian support and arms and training and so forth. The Sadrs stayed in Iraq and tried to work, I guess you'd say, within the system, not effectively because it was very repressive.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when we got rid of Saddam 4 years ago, Sadr was there, as he'd been all along building his movement. And we helped the Hakims come back to Iraq from Iran, where they began to set up shop and build their paramilitary army and death squads and all of that stuff. So basically what we did was bring the Iranian faction back to Iraq in 2003. And it's an abiding mystery in a way why the neoconservatives, the far right, in the Bush administration, who detest and despise Iran, got into bed with Iran's agents in Iraq. Why is it that we helped these pro-Iranian Shiites come and take over Iraq? And
is the answer to that Ahmed Chalabi?
Well, he's a big answer to it. Chalabi actually spent a lot of his time in Iran when he wasn't living it up in London or the Riviera, and he was very close to these religious groups, and he told the neoconservatives, you know, don't worry, they'll be our friends, and I can control them, and so forth. He also helped spread the notion, which the neoconservatives had for a long time, that the Shia Arabs weren't really Arabs, you know, that they're the Sunnis were the Arabs, the ones that dominate Egypt and Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm.
and that the Shia were kind of, you know, not quite Arabs. And so just as the old imperialist and colonial powers saw this divide-and-conquer notion, looking for minorities that they could connect with, a lot of the neoconservatives felt that the Shia would be a pro-American force against, You remember Al-Qaeda was the enemy then a few years ago, and they were Sunnis, and so we thought, well, maybe the Shia will be better. And it's really just based on a utterly ignorant and naive reading of how Arab politics actually works.
We're talking with Robert Dreyfus here on the Tom Hartman program. The piece that we're describing is in the new issue, the May 20th issue of The American Prospect, and I believe you can find it at robertdreyfus.com as well. Bob, I got a piece yesterday that came in from Tom Dispatch under your byline, and in it you talk about the run-up in the defense budget, and in particular of interest to our listeners, you point out that other than Kucinich and Bill Richardson, the Democratic candidates don't even talk about the possibility of cutting defense spending, and it's now ratcheted up to a projected $650 billion in the coming year.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing what's happened to military spending in this country. I think even if you subtract the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq out of the equation, the military budget has doubled since the mid-1990s. And it's doubled with really no state enemy to fight. We don't have any Nazi Germany. We don't have any Soviet Russia that we're arming against.
Bob, you're making me feel nostalgic for the concept of the peace dividend. Remember that?
Yeah, actually there was a mini peace dividend in the early to mid-90s.
It never trickled down to me.
Well, you probably felt it somewhere in your tax bill, but defense spending did decline for 4 or 5 years at the end of the, you know, after the Cold War ended.
Mm-hmm.
But it really exploded under the Bush administration again. And there's been a vast increase in military spending on multi-hundred-billion-dollar weapons systems and, you know, building up the Army and the Marines and doing all of this with no real explanation of who the enemy is. I mean, the last thing you need to fight al-Qaeda is aircraft carriers and intercontinental ballistic missiles and you know, B-2 stealth bombers and all of that stuff. I mean, when a cell of radical Muslims in London can quietly get together and start blowing up buses, you know, what are we going to do, bomb London, the suburbs of London? Or the war against terrorism, which is a term that I hate. But efforts to combat international terrorism is the job of CIA and FBI and law enforcement people who can do the kind of patient, cell-by-cell spying and dismantling of these groups, and not the armed forces. So,
well, somebody tried to explain asymmetrical warfare to Bush, but that word is just so long and complicated, it just didn't compute for him. And,
yeah.
Bob, now we have Bush over there at the G8 summit, and even before they have engaged, he and Putin have launched a war of words, essentially trying to come up with a new Cold War, and we'd probably have to spend another $100 billion a year on that.
Well, we're already spending billions of dollars to put a missile defense system right up smack against Russia's border in Eastern Europe. And why exactly we're doing that when it's such a provocative step, why we're expanding NATO. You know, we've added a dozen, 15 countries to NATO since the end of the Cold War. Now there's talk about even further expansion into Central Asia, and maybe Israel might join NATO. I mean, this was a military alliance designed to combat the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet
right.
alliance, and
mm-hmm.
and so we're pushing Russia into a corner, and it shouldn't be surprising that radical nationalists and anti-American forces and people who golly just don't like us in Russia. Start getting their act together again. So,
well, we have a hard time listening to enemies or potential enemies, but I think Putin has some strong points. We want to enhance this radar system in the Czech Republic. We want to put the Star Wars defense system that doesn't work into Poland. And he rightly points out that this is a defense from a non-existent threat. Iran doesn't have the missiles to deliver payloads, even should they develop nuclear weapons. And so it's pointless, and I think that Putin's caution there is well taken.
And not only that, you know, the war in Afghanistan has allowed us to build bases and military alliances and other defense relationships with a whole bunch of countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union in Central Asia.
The stands, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's starting to feel like we're surrounding Russia, which isn't supposed to be an enemy anymore.
That's right. Bob Dreyfus, thanks for your work. Always interesting to talk with you. Go to Robert Dreyfus, DREYFUSS.com to read more. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much.
All right. More of your calls coming up next. React to what you just heard at 866-303-2270. I'm Peter B. for Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom and Louise remain in Dubrovnik, Croatia. And Tom will be live with you again tomorrow at the usual time by satellite. And I'll be here again on Friday. My name's Peter B. Collins. If you'd like to connect with me, you can send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com, or bigmouth@peterbcollins.com. It'll all reach me. Let's take some more phone calls here. It looks like who's been holding the longest? Diane in Linwood, Washington. Thanks for checking in today. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm responding to the woman who was talking about bombing poor little Serbia by Clinton.
Yes.
My niece married a young man who fled Bosnia with his mother and grandmother when the Serbs were coming. His grandmother didn't make it out in time, and they tortured her. Those people have settled in Spokane, Washington. They are the most wonderful, devoted American citizens. And their view of Serbia is certainly different from that woman's. There was wholesale slaughter and raping by Milosevic and his henchmen.
Yeah.
I wonder why that woman feels that is evil, and if she would have been against fighting the Nazis. There's a time when we have to stand up and for defenseless people, and I'm astonished that someone could defend Serbia as a poor, defenseless little nation. That's absurd.
Well, I agree, and I gently pointed that out. Maybe I should have been a little sharper with her, but I wanted to let her offer her point of view, and I offered mine. So thank you for checking in, Diane. I appreciate that. Now to Tim in Denver, Colorado. Hello, Tim. You're on the Tom Hartman program. This is Peter B.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for taking my call.
Peter, Tim, I hate it when you say that. Talk radio is based on people like you who call in, offer your point of view. You languish on hold for days at a time.
Thank you, sir.
So thank you for calling, Tim. Tell me what's on your mind.
I am a U.S. citizen, originally from Iran.
Uh-huh.
And clearly it shows that neither side, Democrats and Republicans, really do not have a plan for Iraq. And let's be honest with ourselves. The real winner with Iraqi conflict is the Iranian government. And the U.S. policy from Reagan to Bush has always been appeasing the Iranian government. Reagan sent the cake. Clinton labeled the Iranian opposition terrorists as a goodwill gesture to Tehran. And Bush bombed the Iranian opposition bases in Iraq. Really, the solution for Iraq, as the person that you interviewed, is the threat of the Islamic fundamentalism led by the Iranian government and its influence inside Iraq, such as Hakim, mm-hmm. such as Nouri Maliki. All of these people, they resided in Iran for 20, 25 years. And in order to stop Iran's influence, remember, troop escalation is fruitless. Having diplomatic relationship with Iran, it's been going on since Reagan. We sent cake, did everything. And the only way to do this is to stop Iran's influence, and you stop Iran's influence by removing the Iranian opposition from the terrorist list. It's the same group that has revealed the Iran's nuclear ambition. It's the same group that has given the real intelligence to the commanders on the ground. And that's what we need to do. Otherwise,
so, Tim, do you support the Bush administration's ratcheting up of pressure on Iran and the threats even most recently delivered by Dick Cheney on an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf?
It's not really a threat. I mean, Dr. Rice said that our policy towards Iran is not regime change, it's change of behavior. These things...
Do you believe that?
I'm sorry?
Do you believe that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think,
I'm not so sure.
Well, if their policy towards Iran is a military attack, first of all, it's the biggest mistake. Iran is not Iraq. Iran is four times bigger than Iraq. They know that.
I agree with you there.
Military commanders have said that we have absolutely no intelligence from Iran. What is going on, Peter, is to allow the Iranian government to take over Iraq. Wall Street Journal reported just a couple months ago that the Iranian money is being exchanged in south of Iraq. And 80-90% of the Iraqi government members are the Iranian agents. And it was the Iranian opposition, led by Ms. Maryam Rajavi, who revealed a list of 32,000 Iraqi members of the government who received payroll from the Iranian government.
Mm-hmm.
So we have no intelligence, Peter. We have proved that we have no intelligence. The only source that has intelligence, we have labeled them terrorists because we want to appease the Iranian government.
All right, Tim. Well, thank you. Thank you for your call today. You're well informed, and I appreciate your point of view. Let's jump to Janice in Long Beach, listening to KTLK in Los Angeles. Go ahead, Janice.
Good morning. And, I was going to say thank you for taking my call.
Oh, thank you for not saying that.
I'm sorry. It was just so automatic. But the gentleman that just called is so correct. And everybody is so correct. But putting all the pieces together, like with your good interview with Mr. Dreyfus, I think the end game, obviously, is becoming so obvious that they're playing both ends against the middle everywhere, all over the world, just to instigate perpetual, constant, eternal war and chaos, because these people who have taken over our country are profiting so hugely. I think it's become very obvious. I think that is the end game. I think all the other steps along the way are just ways. I don't think it's ignorance that they're provoking Iran, that they don't understand. I think they do understand what they're doing. I really attribute a lot more malevolence to them, and I think they are achieving their end game, unfortunately.
Well, Janice, I wish I had a real arsenal of arguments to throw at you to prove that you're wrong, but I don't.
Yeah.
And we search for explanations about why these people, who are not stupid, you know, they may be ideologues and be driven by the wrong motives, but I don't believe they are stupid. And to see them stir up the Middle East, provoke these additional confrontations, put Americans at greater risk, either here or abroad, we really do seek an explanation there. And when you start to scratch your head and look at the possibilities, the profit motive and the power that comes with it, do appear to be drivers here. And again, I wish I could refute your comments, but I think they're pretty much on target. Thanks for your call this hour. And thanks for listening to this hour of the Tom Hartman Program. We'll continue after the news at the top of the hour, and we'll take more of your calls, too, at 866-303-2270. From San Francisco, I'm Peter B. Collins, here on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Welcome to this hour of the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco. As you know, Tom is in Dubrovnik, the former Yugoslavia there in Croatia. He'll be live with you again tomorrow, Thursday, and then I'll be back with you on Friday here on the National Tom Hartman Program. We have lines open if you'd like to join us. Well, I lied. There's one line open. 866-303-2270. Toll free, 866-303-2270. We'll go to the phones here shortly. Paul Waldman joins us now from MediaMatters.org. That's Media Matters for America. Paul, how are you today?
Good, Peter. How are you?
Nice to talk with you. And Media Matters published a report just last week, cleverly entitled Left Behind, and that, of course, is lifted from the Tim LaHaye book series on Armageddon. Left Behind, the skewed representation of religion in the major news media. And it's not surprising, but it is noteworthy that when the corporate media goes to talk to people of faith, almost 3 times to 1, they get conservatives over progressives. And if you take a look at MediaMatters.org and click on the link on the homepage to this report, it is stunning when you see the graphs how much more conservatives are quoted on religious issues than progressives. Tell us a little bit about how this study was conducted and how you separated some of the superstars who have Rev in front of their names, like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson and, Focus on the Family, Jim Dobson. You put them aside into a separate category.
Right. We wanted to see just who the media turns to when they want to talk about religious issues and represent the views of religious Americans. Because the fact of the matter is that most religious Americans are not conservative. There are certainly plenty of conservative religious folk, but there are even more moderate religious people and progressive religious people. So what we did was we took every religious leader we could think of and assessed how often they get interviewed, how often they get quoted, how often they get mentioned, and we came up with a top 10 list of progressive religious leaders and a top 10 list of conservative religious leaders. And it turns out, as you said, that the conservative religious leaders get quoted and talked about almost, it depends what medium you're talking about. In TV, almost four times as often. In major newspapers, almost three times as often. As you mentioned, we wanted to think about those people who were just sort of asked to comment on the news, on public issues, as opposed to those sort of newsmakers who are celebrities in and of themselves. So, although we counted up the numbers for people like Al Sharpton and Jerry Falwell, we put those in a special section so people could see, but we're really talking about those people who are just supposed to be kind of a representative of religious voters. And what we see over and over and over again is that when reporters want to add that element to their story, they're turning to the conservatives. And that doesn't accurately represent what the American people believe.
Now, I'm looking at a graph here from November 3rd, 2004 through December 31st, 2006. Far and away, the lead spokesperson, the go-to guy, is Tony Perkins. And what does he have, a satellite uplink in his backyard, and he's always available 24/7? Why does the media go to Tony Perkins?
Well, he is the head of the Family Research Council, which is an offshoot of Focus on the Family, and they profess to represent Christian voters. He's somebody who just gets quoted all the time. There are other people like Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention, a very conservative guy.
Mm-hmm.
He gets quoted a lot. And when you turn to those progressive religious leaders, what you find is that they're not really getting discussed all that often. And it's not as though, you know, they're not out there. They've got plenty to say. You know, when we unveiled this study, we had a press conference in Washington with a number of those progressive religious leaders. As they said, they're involved in politics. They want to talk about these issues, but they're not getting those calls from reporters, because I think that a lot of political reporters in particular, not so much the religion reporters, but the political reporters, when they think, oh, well, I want to just mention something about how religious voters are going to be affected by this or that issue, well, I'll just call up one of these conservative guys because they represent what religious people are thinking. But the fact is they don't. It doesn't necessarily mean that just getting a quote from a second person is going to represent the full complexity of what religious people think on any issue, because obviously this is an extraordinarily diverse country religiously, as it is in every other way. But it wouldn't hurt, if you're going to write a story about religion and politics, to talk to a progressive also and not just get the most conservative voices.
Indeed. And ranking them, Tony Perkins got almost 700 interviews in radio, television, and newspapers in the period I mentioned, November of 04 to December of 06. Jim Wallace of Sojourners, who is one of the leading progressive religious voices, he came in at just under 500. Franklin Graham under just under 400. Then Michael Lerner is the next progressive, and his is barely over 100. So the drop-off there from the top progressive to the number two is very sharp, while it's a little bit more tailored on the conservative side. Gary Bauer comes in third, Richard Land fourth of the Southern Baptist Convention, and Charles Colson, the Watergate felon and founder of his own group, he comes in fifth there among the conservatives. And Bob Edgar, National Council of Churches, he's just moved over to head up Common Cause. He is tied with Michael Lerner at roughly 100 interviews during that time period, or sound bites, whatever the quotes were. Then Tony Campolo and Rabbi David Saperstein round out the top five for progressives. And what was the response from the mainstream media to this stunning report, Paul Waldman?
I've had some good conversations with reporters about this who have acknowledged that they don't do this enough. They don't go to the progressives enough. We've seen some coverage in the religious media. People are interested in this issue, and we're hoping that it'll start a conversation. You know, as I said, this is not the only question you could ask about coverage of religion. Coverage of religion, especially as it relates to politics, is oversimplified in a lot of ways. But I think at a bare minimum, you would hope that there would be a diversity of voices that are represented there. And I think that one of the things that people may not understand is that some of the people who are the most prominent conservative voices, like Pat Robertson or like the late Reverend Falwell, they're not just political radicals, they're theological radicals too. And most Christians look at someone like Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson and think, that guy doesn't represent me, he's kind of crazy. All the talk about impending Armageddon and, God bringing 9/11 down on America because of gay people, most religious religious Americans don't think that way. But that's the picture that gets painted. And, you know, over time, as you have all of these stories where the only religious voices are the conservative voices, well, I think one of the messages it sends to people is that if you're a religious person, then your natural home is with conservatives and in the Republican Party. Now, the Republican Party is very happy to have that message get sent. That's the message they want to send. But I don't think it's a true representation of where people are religiously, but that's the direction they're being pushed.
Yeah, very interesting stuff. Thanks for your work, Paul, and thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure as always.
Paul Waldman from Media Matters. Go to their website, mediamatters.org, and read this study for yourself. And next time you're watching TV and you see one of the conservative evangelicals pop up, maybe it'll remind you that progressives are generally squeezed out of media coverage. Let's take more of your calls. Al in Long Island, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter B. How are you today?
Thank you. Very good. Thanks. One large population in the Middle East that has not been covered sufficiently in U.S. media, Kurds. Kurds with 40 million population divided between Turkey, Iran, and Iraq and Syria,
mm-hmm.
has shown in Iraq that they could be a front runner for democracy. This is the only functioning unit in Iraq that proven that they could establish a multi-political system, multi-religious system with tolerance to Christians, Jews, and others. And this population also extends to the Iran, and they are struggling for the same democratic principles in Iran as well as in Turkey and as well as in Syria.
Well, Al, I agree with you that the Kurds are definitely further along than the Shiites and the Sunnis in Iraq. I think the biggest problem is, and the U.S. has not come to terms with this, is that Turkey has such a hard line toward the Kurds, both those in southern Turkey and those across the border in Iraq. And they are very concerned about an independent Kurdistan or anything like that surfacing to challenge the government in Ankara. And I think that's one of the issues that has to be addressed as we try to move forward here and stabilize Iraq.
That is definitely correct. In Turkish, the stability in Turkey is a benefit for the Kurds and everyone else. I think military in Turkey is in charge of the political decision-making process. They are acting as if they are a political party and influencing the public opinion. And today, as you heard from the news, they are invading the northern Iraq or Iraqi Kurdistan to suppress what they call terrorists. But the problem is much wider. The Kurds are not only in eastern, southeastern Turkey, but they are in Istanbul, Izmir, Ankara. I think Turkey is a very vulnerable country now for any terrorist activities. It's important to support democracy.
Al, thank you for your call. This is Peter B. Collins on the Tom Hartman Program, 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Seen it all before. We know what it's all about. He lied to get us into war. He'll lie to get us out. Fool this one more time. Like no one's keeping score.
Congratulations. You have the good judgment of tuning into the Tom Hartman Program, and you found me here today. I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom, who's in Dubrovnik in Croatia. He'll be live from there tomorrow. I want to give a shout-out to Chris Lopresto at the controls at Air America in New York, and Lauren B. Kirchner, who's taking your calls at 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. I want to thank Al for his thoughtful call just before the break. And here are details. Several thousand Turkish troops crossed into northern Iraq early Wednesday to chase Kurdish guerrillas who operate from bases there, according to Turkish security officials. Two senior officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the raid was limited in scope and that it did not constitute the kind of large incursion the Turkish leaders have been discussing in recent weeks. It's not a major offensive, and the number of troops is not in the tens of thousands. Okay. The officials didn't say where the Turkish force was operating in northern Iraq, nor how long they planned to be there. So this is something that bears watching. If you recall, before our misguided invasion of Iraq, The Bush administration tried very hard to pressure, including using cash bribes of up to $5 or $6 billion, to pressure the Turkish government into permitting us to deploy troops from Turkey into Iraq, and they wisely declined. Now it appears they're freelancing here, although we can't be sure of that. But it does, it is a situation that I think we should keep an eye on. Let's go to Barbara in Cave Creek, Arizona, listening on KPHX, my old radio home. Hello, Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, first of all, I just wanted to comment that there's a misconception about Croatia and Serbia because of World War II. The Croats actually were like a little Nazi Germany with concentration camps, and they killed Serbs, Jews, Gypsies, and fascist Croats. So the Serbs got the reputation of being the victims from that, but mm-hmm. Milosevic should change everything. But I also wanted to say that I think it's really strange that it was in the news in Denver that they're closing NORAD. And the reason why they're saying they're closing NORAD and they're moving it is because, according to Admiral Tim Keating, it leads us to believe a missile attack from China or Russia is very unlikely, but if Bush keeps doing what he's doing, we're going to have to open it up again.
Well, NORAD did a great job for us on 9/11, didn't they, Barbara?
Well, my theory is that he's working for somebody else. And our enemies must be scratching their heads trying to do stuff to us, because every time they come up with something, they're going to go, but Bush already did it to them. You know, they ruined the army, destroyed the economy. I mean, what else can he, you know, destroyed our atmosphere, just, you know, taking down NORAD. I mean, what else? They have to be sitting there. No wonder why they're not coming here. They don't have to.
Well, yeah, we're fighting them over there, right? So we don't have to fight them here.
Well, we're fighting ourselves. He's doing the job for him.
All right, Barbara, thank you. Now we've got Barbara in Los Angeles. Hello, Barbara. You're on the Tom Hartman Show with Peter B. Collins.
Hello, Peter. This perhaps is off the topic of everything everybody's talking about, but something that has scared the living daylights out of me is that on May 9th, President Bush signed something called the National Security Presidential Directive.
That's right.
And that gives him the right to decide what is a national emergency and to declare martial law and whatever else he feels he can do. And a short time after that, about as far as I know, a week and a half or so, it appears that Halliburton is given a $350 million no-bid contract to build detention camps in America.
Now, well, wait. The Halliburton no-bid detention camp deal is over a year old. And
well,
the directive that you're talking about was issued just about a month ago.
Yeah, well, then the first time I heard about the Halliburton thing to build detention camps was just last week. But hearing about that on top of this presidential directive,
right?
You know, when are we going to wake up to the fact that this country is not near a democracy anymore? And all of this talk about the Turks and the Kurds and the this and the that and all the other stuff means nothing compared to what these people are up to around the world. And
well, I'm glad, Barbara, I'm glad you're paying attention. This is very important. I want to jump to Rich on the other coast in Long Island. He has the same concern. Rich, go right ahead. You're on the air on the Tom Hartman program.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Oh, I hate it when you say that. Go ahead.
Yeah. I enjoy your show, though. I mean, you're doing a good job here.
Thanks.
Anyway, some friends of mine and I have been concerned for the last couple of years that, you know, in the final analysis, when the day after Bush's presidency is over, he's still going to be in office because he's gradually assuming more and more right to declare martial law and that kind of thing.
Yes, he's becoming an authoritarian thug.
And we're
sitting back and worried more about Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, that's what I should be doing, right?
Yeah, you should be over there trying to get Paris out of jail.
Yeah, no, that's important stuff. That's national stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But,
well,
Rich,
I'm glad you're concerned. I'm up against a break here, but I think people need to pay attention. These are not things that are trivial. And we need to keep our eyes open and remain vigilant in the march to fascism. It's something I'm very concerned about. We'll take a break and return with an American protester next on the Tom Hartman program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
I'm Peter B. Collins here on the Tom Hartman program today.
Those who start wars never fight them.
Political world beat from Michael Fronte and Spearhead. This one's called Time to Go Home. We take you now to the Federal Building at 104 East Magnolia Street in Bellingham, Washington, where Evan Knappenberger, who served in Iraq with the 4th Infantry Division, is conducting a week-long vigil. Evan Knappenberger, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing okay today. Tell us why you're doing this.
Well, I'm trying to draw some attention to the stop-loss program, which is the Army's policy of extending their soldiers' contracts, and it's not really legal. And I'm trying to draw some attention to that in order to get that fixed.
And it's what people call the backdoor draft, by retaining forces, including reservists and National Guardsmen who never expected to spend extended tours in a foreign war zone. We are augmenting our presence in the occupation of Iraq by holding our troops there longer. And just recently, Robert Gates announced that a year is 15 months.
Absolutely. They did a study that said that it's more stable for soldiers to be in Iraq for 15 months than it is for 12. And it's better for the families, apparently, of these soldiers.
How many tours have you done in Iraq, Evan Knappenberger?
I spent a year there, Peter.
Uh-huh. And did they extend your tour longer than you had expected?
No, I was expecting that to happen. Fortunately, it didn't. I was about to get stop-lossed by the Army when I got out of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
I missed it by a few days, but all my friends who spent about 2 years, I think is the average they spent, most of them are getting stop-lossed, and they'll be spending 15 months there minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Partly.
And so for you, what is the remedy here? Should we actually break down and draft young Americans into military service?
Well, I'm not really advocating any remedy. I've definitely heard that. I've talked to about 1,500 people, and a lot of them are in agreement that if not just, then it would at least be more fair to have normal American kids doing their part as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would definitely send a message to a lot of these apathetic college kids if they had to fill out a draft card.
So you believe that that would be a way of distributing the pain and the responsibility for serving our country during a time of war, even if we don't support the policy?
Well, that's one way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. And what are other remedies to draw down American troops in Iraq? That would be one way of bringing people home, not continuing with the backdoor draft.
Oh, absolutely. It's not really a just war. I'm anti-war myself. I'm trying to keep that out of my protest to as much as I can. But I am definitely anti-war, and that would be, I think, the best way of ending the stop-loss, just mm-hmm. ending the war altogether.
So what kind of reaction are you getting from people who pass by your position there at the federal building in Bellingham, Washington?
Well, Peter, it depends on the time of day, but I'd say it's 95% supportive. I've got so much food and flowers and lots of good stuff is coming my way. I know probably 200 or 300 people by face now.
Oh, yeah?
That are our regulars. It's kind of turned into a group therapy session.
And what kind of media coverage have you gotten besides a curious radio guy like me?
Well, I've got a little bit. There's a couple of pieces coming out in various papers across the country. There's a lot on the blogosphere. There's a lot of stuff on the net.
And you have a website that I want to mention at towerguard.org. It's simple, Tower, G-U-A-R-D, towerguard.org.
Yep.
And are you getting a lot of support via the web? Are people emailing you there?
Oh, absolutely. I've been actually, I heard there's two articles online that have designated me the successor to Cindy Sheehan, actually.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah? Well, do you want to buy 5 acres in Crawford?
No, I'm not a big fan of Texas. I spent 2 or 3 years there in the Army.
Uh-huh.
And it's not the place for me.
Okay. Well, Evan, thank you for speaking out on behalf of your brothers and sisters in uniform and the unfairness, the indignity that has been imposed upon them through the stop-loss programs. And I'm glad you're doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Okay, great to talk with you. Again, that's Evan Knappenberger. He served in Iraq. And he is conducting a 1 week personal protest at the federal building in Bellingham, Washington. And you can read all about it and see pictures of his scene and him at towerguard.org. That's towerguard.org. Back to your phone calls now at 866-303-2270. And let's see, I like to see who's been holding the longest. Paula in Carbondale, Illinois. Paula, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. It's about time you took my call.
Oh, good. You're right. I like aggressive people.
Well, I just wanted to respond to that one woman that called and also recommend 3 books.
Okay.
The one woman that called said that we should have bombed Yugoslavia because shouldn't we have stood up to Nazi Germany? And the other woman pointed out that Croatia was an ally of Nazi Germany, and the Ustashi was so vicious that even the Nazi SS was like, ew, these people are nasty.
Mm-hmm.
And when the United States got involved in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, they actually helped put a former Ustashi into power in Croatia. So that I just wanted to point out that this, you know, it isn't a matter of fighting the Nazis. It was really a matter of supporting the Nazis when the United States bombed Yugoslavia. But I just want to say, I want to recommend these books because, like Noam Chomsky points out, it's really hard in 1 minute to overcome years of propaganda. So I would recommend Noam Chomsky's A New Generation Draws a Line,
mm-hmm.
Michael Parenti, To Kill a Nation, and Martin Lee, The Beast Reawakens, for a little information about the U.S. support of Nazis and Nazi sympathizers after World War II and definitely into the 90s.
Okay, great. Chomsky, Parenti, and Lee.
Yes.
We'll add that to our reading list. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call, Paula. Now to Frank in Georgia. Hello, Frank. You're on the Tom Hartman Program, and I'm Peter B.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Okay, thanks.
Barbara was right. The second last caller, Barbara, closing ORAD and dictator powers, that all has to do with losing our country. It's a one-world government. They've been planning this for years and years and years. They want to bring us to our knees, and gosh darn, I'm just a common truck driver, and I'm to my knees, and the money I made 6 years ago don't go. I mean, I lost 10-15%.
Mm-hmm. Well, Frank, you know, I'm a little wary of the idea of the one-world government theories, and some of that comes from the far right, and some of it comes from the far left. But for me, I'm focused on the Bush administration and what they have done to our government, to our nation, to our Constitution. And I'm deeply concerned about that. And maybe there is some plot for a one-world government, but that's not too material to me at the moment. What I see is a president who trotted out his themes about freedom just yesterday in a speech at Prague Castle. And he appears to be oblivious or just, you know, downright evil. Because here he talks about freedom, talks about democracy, and he is presiding over a rollback of our rights here in this country. And unfortunately, we don't have enough opposition from the Democrats. They're aware of the issues. There's a move now to try to rein in the Military Commissions Act and the torture policy and the detention policies. But there's not enough fight back on the NSA spying program and the other efforts that I think are a real threat to our way of life and our way of government. So I thank you for your call today. Let's jump to Tim in Los Angeles. Tim, got a minute here. You're on the air on the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, Peter, thanks for having me on. You know, the good thing about, I guess you could say, the religious right was, what's his name? Tim LaHaye.
Tim LaHaye wrote the Left Behind series.
Right, and out of that group, he created an organization or group that bans or wants to ban RFID chips in humans, products, pets, and so on and so forth. Because I guess out of all that evil, there was something good out of it.
Well, I'm not in favor of those chips, but are they concerned that at Judgment Day they won't be able to tell the righteous from the rest of us?
well, not necessarily that, but the privacy when it comes to, like, individual choices and whatnot. I mean, mm-hmm. That's their concern.
All right, Tim, thanks for bringing that forward. That wasn't Tim LaHaye, was it? I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Your calls and comments are welcome at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Hey, it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. I'm Peter B. Collins from San Francisco, sitting in for Tom today. He'll be back live tomorrow from Dubrovnik, and then I'll be here again on Friday as he wings his way back to the United States. Catching up on a couple of emails here, and my email address, by the way, peter@peterbcollins.com. You're welcome to drop by the website and catch archives of my West Coast syndicated program and more information about me. That's www.peterbcollins.com. And Daryl checked in. He tried the link to the protester, Evan Knappenberger. That website, again, is towerguard.org. Make sure it's org, and tower, G-U-A-R-D. Also, a listener tried to access the article that Robert Dreyfus was talking about. Apparently, it's not at his personal website. You can find it at prospect.org. That's the website of the American Prospect magazine, prospect.org. And I see it here on the homepage titled, Is There a Nationalist Solution in Iraq? By Robert Dreyfus. Hope that catches everybody up. And let's see who sent this in. Jim A., brought to my attention a story that I heard briefly on the Stephanie Miller show earlier today. And the dateline is Manchester, New Hampshire, where the Republicans gathered for the CNN group grope last night. And a freelance reporter, Mike Lepacek, who reports for Infowars.com, was arrested for asking a question posed to one of Giuliani's staff members in a press conference. Apparently the question was about the collapse of Building 7. And as a result, the press secretary called New Hampshire State Police, and Lepacek was arrested, and apparently police damaged a camera in the process of arresting him. I didn't know it was illegal for a reporter to ask a question at a news conference. And I think Giuliani has some explaining to do here, because he comes across as enough of a hardline authoritarian already. And I'd like to know more about this, and it appears that an apology is in order from the Giuliani camp. Marie in Tempe, Arizona, you're next here on the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome. This is Peter B.
Hi, and first of all, I want to say thank you, and I would like to know more, too, about that story. I think we all should know why reporters are not being able to ask questions. And I have some information. There was a whistleblower that had given some information out to the American Freedom to Fascism organization. We had a conference call last night, and I wanted to pass it along to you privately. I wanted to give the outline, but give the how to get in touch with him to you to get an interview if you'd like to.
Sure. Can you just drop me an email?
Okay.
That's the best way.
Okay. It's about the biometrics and industries,
mm-hmm.
about the ID Act, and the facial scanning and palm scanning. He has information that shows the L1 identity solutions has lied about the results, that is saying the accuracy. They say that it's 90%, and which it's not. And he is, you know, risking his life to bring this information out, and I mm-hmm. wanted to let you and everybody else know that this ID Act and biometrics is very dangerous because it's going into an international database
mm-hmm.
where our information is gathered and can be used against us. I mean, not everyone is out for our best interest, and some information should be stopped. And we are at the crossroads of, you know, is it, well, like your other callers have been implying.
I'll put it this way, Marie. We are creeping toward fascism and a police state in this country. And the way that Bush has tried to whip up fear and continues to do so about terrorist attacks as a reason for taking away our freedoms does not wash with me. And I want to see more backbone from Democrats really fighting about these issues. John Edwards is on the right track as he declares the so-called war on terror to be nothing more than a bumper sticker. But we need to hear very strong, clear statements from the Democratic candidates about what our rights are and what they will do to protect, nurture, and expand them after the contraction that we've been through recently. Thanks for your call today. Now to Tony in Minneapolis. Hello, Tony. You're on the Tom Hartman program. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Peter.
Hello, Tony.
You know, I want to go back to the gentleman from Media Matters.
Uh-huh.
And who spoke about why you have a lot of these extreme right-wing religious people on the air.
Right.
I listened to a radio program. It was a religious program over the weekend. And the owner or the presenter of that program, he's more liberal in his theology. And he speaks of being on a plane with a producer on a radio program, and he asks, or TV station, and he asks, why do you have these extreme people on there?
Mm-hmm.
And his response was, well, we bring them on for comedy relief or comic relief.
Oh, jeez.
You know?
Uh-huh.
And
well, unfortunately, they forgot the laugh track.
Yeah, but, you know, I think we underestimate these guys like the Jerry Bowers or the Farwells, because with them, they want to be on CNN and all that, because they know otherwise nobody's going to take them seriously. Just like,
well, but you need to be aware that Falwell, Robertson, Dobson, they have their own media networks, and they are very powerful and very effective in maneuvering and mobilizing their viewers and listeners when they want to make a political statement. And I don't underestimate them in any way.
Yeah, but the trouble with these producers who are not religious, you know, they don't see that the way you see it, you know?
Right. And you're correct that Falwell and those types of people, you know, have wanted to get on mainstream television because it helps expand their credibility.
Exactly.
And reach people who are not part of their choir. But it's something we need to watch very carefully because it's off the radar for most Americans. And there are thousands of religious radio stations that aren't just doing Bible teaching. They're linking Bible teaching to political activism. And it's not in my best interest. I certainly know that. Thanks for your call. We'll take more calls in the next hour at 866-303-2270. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco on the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And this is Peter B. Collins in San Francisco. Happy to be sitting in for Tom Hartman again today. As you know, Tom is in Dubrovnik, Croatia, in the former Yugoslavia. He'll be live from there tomorrow via satellite, and so you can check in with him. Then I'll be back Friday as he wings his way back to the United States, and the regular schedule resumes next week. We're taking your calls this hour. No guests scheduled, and we'll just play it by ear here, see what you have to say. 866-303-2270. All the lines are jammed up right now, but when somebody hangs up, you can grab a line. And before we go to your calls, I'd just like to make two simple statements. There are two people in Washington, D.C., who really got to go. One is a Democrat named William Jefferson, a congressman from Louisiana. We'll talk about him in a moment. The other is the Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez. Mr. Amnesia, the guy who simply can't remember. I got no memory of anything at all. That's the way it goes.
It was a long day for a guy with a short memory.
Sir, I don't recall. Senator, I don't recall remembering.
To help Alberto Gonzalez recall what he doesn't remember was this guy keeping score, a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. He and a handful of protesters made themselves hard to forget during breaks in the hearing.
That's Code Pink and Medea Benjamin, by the way.
Attorney General's legal positions. Also keeping tabs on Gonzalez's memory was The Daily Show.
I can only testify as to what I recall. Senator, I don't recall. I firmly believe that nothing improper occurred.
But he assures you what he doesn't remember was handled properly.
Didn't invent, I don't recall. It's a time-dishonored tradition.
I have to say I don't recall that at all.
I just don't recall that.
I recall making the decision.
When?
Sir, I don't recall when the decision was made.
Ha ha, go ahead and laugh. But I've personally made plenty of decisions that I recall making, but I don't recall when I made them. Not that I recall any examples. See, right there, two, I don't recall. Though that's nowhere near Gonzalez's total for the day-long hearing.
74 times. I don't recall. How did he get through law school?
How did she get into the Senate with that get-up? Free speech.
95 Gonzalez right now.
As for the guy keeping score, he sure was a hit on the liberal blogs. The man with the digits is making me swoon. That guy is totally hot, and he can count past 50. Yep, Adam Kokesh got all the way to 74. I can't recall.
It was actually a lot more than that. If you include the I don't knows and I am not aware of, it would have been probably close to 400.
Just to refresh your memory.
Senator, I don't recall. I had forgotten.
Maybe it would have been less work to count these.
I do recall.
Chemo, CNN, New York.
Well, that is humorous, and it's also tragically sad. That here is the top law enforcement official in our government who pretends that he doesn't remember, he can't recall. And one of his underlings, Bradley Schlotzman, was up on the Hill yesterday, and he was offering a lot of that same amnesia. He did confirm some of the political motivations for the insider operations there in the Justice Department. And it's a sorry saga that will only end when Alberto Gonzalez submits his resignation. And absent that, I believe he should be impeached. I don't think the Democrats should be sitting there with these polite no-confidence votes and that kind of thing. I think it's time to just impeach the sucker. And I said sucker. I hope you heard that clearly. Also, Bill Jefferson should resign. And on a program like this, a lot of people think that we pull punches and protect Democrats. But while I will allow Mr. Jefferson to assert his innocence until he is convicted in a court of law, the evidence appears to be overwhelming, And this is a deep embarrassment to the Democrats who are trying to set a tone of better ethics in Washington. And it's created a target for the predatory leader of the Republicans in the House, John Boehner, who turns a blind eye to the corruption of his colleagues and the investigations that remain underway. Just two California congressmen, Doolittle and Lewis, both deserve a full ethics investigation, and I believe they should resign because of the corruption that they're accused of. Boehner never mentions them, but he wants the Ethics Committee in the House to fast-track an expulsion of William Jefferson. And while he says these things for the wrong reasons, my bottom line is that, at least practically speaking, I agree with John Boehner. I think Jefferson is an embarrassment and should be expelled from the United States House. Let's go to your phone calls, and I've just developed a technical problem because I overloaded my computer playing I Don't Recall and the Peter Gabriel song all at the same time. So, Chris, tell me who's next on the line. Andrew is up. Andrew, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B.
Hi, Peter. So I came across some timely information about Reggie Walton. He was the guy
who allowed
the Justice Department to put a gag order on Sybil Edmonds, the translator.
Well, wait. Let's back up here. Reggie Walton is the judge who yesterday sentenced Scooter Libby and presided over his trial. And
right.
You're referring to a prior engagement in his court with FBI translator who got fired and became a whistleblower, Sybil
right.
Edmonds, who I know quite well.
Okay. Yeah. And so the session was held in camera, I think is what it's called, with only the prosecution or the Justice Department officials present. So in that case, Sybil didn't get her habeas corpus. And so I just thought, you know, it's kind of weird that, you know, this is Libby is being judged by this guy. Who allowed this guy to be appointed? And, you know, it makes it seem like he would probably try to make it seem that Libby shouldn't be tried for anything greater than obstruction of justice and perjury as opposed to treason or outing.
Well, you know, I've had my own misgivings about Judge Walton, but in the comments, you know, I have not been in his courtroom during the Libby proceedings, but I listened to a lot of reporters who were there and read most of the news accounts of the trial, and it does appear that he was relatively fair. And that he dealt with the issues before him. If you want to pick a bone, it would be with Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor, who I believe did not really go far enough in his investigation of these leaks, and that he basically went for the easy mark, which was the obvious dishonesty of Scooter Libby before the grand jury. And in his interviews with investigators prior to that. And so I fault Fitzgerald for not bringing a robust investigation to a robust prosecution that could have actually revealed the truth about the White House group, the White House Iraq group that was led by Karl Rove, that met in the vice president's office, that I believe was, you know, very clearly in charge of the leak of Valerie Plame Wilson's identity. And in my view, they did have a conspiracy there to conduct this outing, this leaking, as a way of trying to protect the vice president and others for their phony pre-war intelligence. And I believe that they used the media as a way of trying to delay the investigation and deflect attention from the leakers at the White House. So, Andrew, thank you for your call today. Now to California, and I'm sorry, Chris, who is it? Steve in California. Welcome. You're on the air here on the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, Peter B., long time.
Nice to hear from you.
Bay Area radio and everything. This is more of a speculation file, going back to Giuliani.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's more of a question. Why did Giuliani lose two cases against John Gotti, two or three, I'm not sure, then the very next attorney general that came behind Giuliani to try Gotti got a conviction, and then when he and Bernie Kerik got together, he recommended Kerik for Homeland Security and didn't want him vetted,
mm-hmm.
and then Kerik was found out to be mob ties. So,
well, those mob ties surfaced when Giuliani appointed him as police commissioner in New York, and he turned a blind eye to it. And because of what you just said, his history as a U.S. attorney, Rudy Giuliani should have been in the forefront of knowing who had mob ties in New York City and who was disqualified as police commissioner. And that says a lot about him. I think we're going to hear more about this as the campaign rolls on. Thanks for your call, Steve. More in a moment here on the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
We continue now on the Tom Hartman Program, Coast to Coast on Air America Radio. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco, and I keep clicking this damn mouse. Can I just share a moment with you? I hate PCs. I have been long associated with Silicon Valley. I have friends at Apple, and I love my Macintosh computers. But there are certain programs that don't run on Macs or don't run well on Macs, despite all the best efforts. And so I broke down and bought a couple of PCs a couple of years ago. And, you know, they're decent little clunkers, and they do okay. But in that last segment, I was playing a YouTube clip and some music at the same time, and it choked on my remote connection to the studio in New York. So I'm rebooting and working to get it back, but it's a little slow. In the meantime, enough of my kvetching. Let's go to Rita in Los Angeles. Hello, Rita. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter Mac-loving B. Collins.
Hey, Peter. I'm wondering, I have a question for you, but it involves three pieces of information. My question for you is why you have a hesitancy to consider the New World Order as an item, a legitimate item. First of all, George Herbert Walker Bush spoke of the New World Order mm-hmm. back during his presidency, during a speech. He just spit it right out there talking about we're ready for a New World Order.
Yes.
Then there's the PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, which speaks of a New American Century and a New World Order. And then there's a NAFTA, which Tom Hartman actually talks as a New World Trade Order.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious about your hesitancy to consider all this.
Well, but the phrase that the caller put forward was one world government. All right? And that usually is spooky conspiracy theories related to the United Nations or, you know, the Trilateral Commission and groups like that. And frankly, I think that we have enough to work with in terms of corporate collusion with governments, including our own. To show us a kind of fascism that is developing between corporations and governments, particularly global corporations. And so I don't dismiss any of the issues that you just raised. Yes, Poppy Bush did talk about a new world order. It was his way of trying to describe a redevised Middle East after his foray there in Desert Storm, the first Persian Gulf War. Secondly, I am aware of PNAC, and I'm very troubled by the blueprints that they have laid out and the extent to which they have built the items included in those built blueprints. And so I don't dismiss the issues that you raise. What I can't find is some central Dr. Evil who is, you know, conspiring to deny us of everything. I think it's our own leaders who are doing that.
Can I give you one in one word?
Sure.
The banksters.
The banksters. Who do you mean?
The World Bank gangsters who operate the World Bank like gangsters. The banksters.
All right, but how does that relate to one world government? The World Bank doesn't have any activities in the United States. They work abroad.
But aren't they all behind the corporate leadership?
Well, I think they do advance the corporate interests, and they do work to support WTO and NAFTA and these other trade deals that I think are bad and have a negative impact on American workers, yes.
So can we say that because fascism, according to Mussolini, is the corporation with the government hand in hand, that there is something to the fact that the World Bank and the IMF is behind all this? I mean, the reason I say this is because I read that John Perkins book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Yeah, I've read that, too. He's an interesting guy.
And that was, don't you think that was kind of what he was saying? That there's this sort of International Monetary Fund, World Bank, thrust into these corporate movements, into the foreign policy that we...
I see it much more as a convenient collusion than a conspiracy by design.
Rita, in other words,
thanks for the call. I want to move on, but I appreciate your thoughts today. Now to Charles in Point Hadlock, Washington. Hello, Charles. You're on the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Peter.
Hello.
I just have a quick statement to make or a comment to make about the draft.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pro-draft. I think if we had a draft, that all of the people, all the citizens would be much more involved with this Iraq war. I think once you make it personal and when people's kids are being drafted and sent overseas, I also think that this Congress or previous Congresses would never have allowed the war to happen in the first place. If they had to answer the people in their districts about drafting their kids and sending them overseas to fight a war that basically is a preemptive war,
mm-hmm.
or a war for oil, I don't think that would have happened.
Well, Charles, I have mixed feelings because I was subject to the draft, and I was number 4 in the draft lottery in 1971, and it changed my life. And in many respects, I am loath to intervene in the lives of young Americans and subject them to military draft. And on the other side of that coin, and I don't want to appear too ambivalent here, I recognize that today's generation of college students has no investment whatsoever in this misbegotten, misguided occupation of Iraq and the war plans of the Bush administration. And I do agree that if we spread that responsibility more broadly across the population, that more people would be up in arms and probably opposed to the war. But I guess it's cause and effect, and it's kind of hard to impose it at this point. Thanks for your thoughts, and maybe other people want to comment too. Give us a call toll-free, 866-303-2270. I'm Peter B. for Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
We continue now on the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco, and I can stop kvetching about my computer now. The PC is back up, although during that 4-day commercial break, I did have time to call tech support in the Philippines, and they advised me to power cycle my modems, which I did. And now I am fully back in connection and back in control, or whatever passes for that. Robert in Detroit's been holding. Welcome, Robert. You're on the Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter B., and don't say thanks for taking my call.
Oh, I would never do that.
Thank you.
If we want to stop the occupation, we have to make sure that George Bush is not allowed to give the oil rights, Iraqi oil rights, to U.S. corporations.
Mm-hmm.
That would pretty much... If he was convinced that he could not do that, I mean, I don't think he'd be so hot to trot about staying there.
Well, and Robert, it's unfortunate, but this is one of the issues where the Democratic leadership doesn't appear to appreciate what you're talking about, because they have embraced benchmarks that originated with the Iraq Study Commission, you know, the Baker-Hamilton Commission last fall. And the Democrats have supported the idea of breaking up the oil rights, or essentially ceding them to multinational corporations, where really only a small fraction of the revenues derived from current fields and the large fields that are expected to yield great reserves in the future, very little of that would trickle down to actual Iraqi citizens. And this is an issue that you can...
17% at best.
Say again?
17% at best.
Yeah. And so it is a crime in progress, if you will. And I'd really like to see some Democrats stand up and say, we do not want to take your oil. That's not in our interest, and that's not in your interest, and we know that. But we're not hearing that so far.
As long as U.S., there's a possibility of U.S. having control of Iraqi oil, the troops will never come back. We're going to run out of young men and women.
Well, I'm glad you raised the point, Robert. Good to hear from you. Also in Motown, Steve joins us now on line 6. Hello, Steve. This is Peter B. Collins. How are you?
Hi, Peter. I'm doing fine. Peter, I have an observation, an opinion, and a question. Peter, my observation is that during the NSA illegal wiretaps, in the newspapers, I would always read high-spirited opinions, headlines like Dick Cheney says Bush didn't break the law, or high-spirited opinions from Ted Kennedy, Bush did break the law. But I would never see the Constitution in print, which would clearly state that the law was broken, or FISA, or a lot of references to FISA in print.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion is that it's easy to subvert the Constitution when the press doesn't print the Constitution. And I'm not talking about their little quotes on the op-ed page once in a while. My question is to you is, what is your feelings on that?
Well, I think it's interesting, for example, that Dennis Kucinich carries a copy of the Constitution in his pocket. And he has whipped it out a couple of times during these so-called debates. And I believe that we really should reference the Constitution more often. If you visit the Peter B. Collins website, what you're going to see is the Constitution, We the People, right there. And I believe that it's the foundation of our government and the rule of our society. And I think that it should be referenced, I think you're correct, much more often than not. The problem is that there are just too many people who think that that's arcane, or as Alberto Gonzalez might say, quaint.
Very good, Peter, and thanks for taking the call.
Oh, you got me. Arthur in El Cerrito, California, listening on 960 The Quake here in the San Francisco Bay Area. How are you, Arthur?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, good. I wanted to follow up on your reference to Fitzgerald's investigation stopping.
Okay, can you get directly on the phone, Arthur? It sounds like you're using a speakerphone.
There, is that better?
Oh, that's loud and clear, 10 by 10.
Great. You know, you're the first person who has voiced my concerns about this, because I remember Fitzgerald saying that it was like throwing sand in an umpire's face, and you couldn't start an investigation until the perjury was cleared up.
Mm-hmm.
So the investigation didn't continue. In my mind, it didn't even start.
Well,
and the person to ask about this is probably Jason Leopold.
Well, Leopold, by the way, is a reporter for truthout.org, and he's done an excellent job covering the Roe issues originally that devolved into the Libby trial.
Right. But Leopold did report that Roe was served a subpoena by the grand jury.
No. Roe made 5 trips to the grand jury.
Uh-huh.
What Leopold reported and is still unresolved is that he believes, based on confidential sources in the building there at the courthouse in Washington, that Karl Rove actually was indicted. And it occurred in May of 2006, and that there was, and I don't know if it's still there, a sealed indictment that was labeled sealed versus sealed.
Yeah.
And typically a sealed indictment will say U.S. versus sealed, but this one was so cryptic that it was written up as sealed versus sealed. And I stand by Jason Leopold's reporting.
Uh-huh.
I don't personally have sources there, and I cannot prove or disprove this
uh-huh.
issue myself. But it appears that games
uh-huh.
were played. And one of the other things we have to look at, and I just want this to provoke your thinking. I'm not prepared to issue an indictment. But consider that the prosecutors, the U.S. attorneys, who played ball with the White House and the Gonzalez rubber stamp Justice Department, most of them kept their jobs. And one could create a scenario where this sacking of U.S. attorneys could have included Patrick Fitzgerald as a way to get him off of the Libby case.
Uh-huh.
Now, that didn't happen, and trying to prove a negative, of course, is always very difficult. But I think it's worth thinking about that Patrick Fitzgerald still has his job, and I don't believe he did a very good job of investigating this whole set of issues.
Just one other thing is that Truthout's website was cracked just after that story was printed about the indictment, the sealed indictment,
mm-hmm.
and that story disappeared. It took about 3 or 4 days for them to get their website back up. It's just, incidental evidence.
All right. Arthur, thank you for checking in today. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Ryan in Modesto. Hello, Ryan. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter B.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call.
Oh, there you go again. You people, don't stop.
Oh, gosh, just joking around. But, hey, to be more serious, I'm an Iraqi freedom veteran.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And I just wanted to make a comment because I've been a Democrat since I'm 18. And I'm 27 now. But I want to know if there's any other Democrats out there listening that think that we need to kind of hold these guys accountable as far as saying that they were elected to end the war and saying that the people spoke. And then they kind of laid over for George Bush when they had the chance to cut the funding.
Well, Ryan, I am in the same position as you. I am disappointed, and I think that there are various activist groups like progressive Democrats who are paying close attention, and they are going to hold accountable even some freshman members of the House who ran on a stop the war, end the war platform and who ended up voting for this supplemental. And I think that it's an important step that has to be taken. I think we really do have to hold these people accountable, even if we agree with them on many other issues, because this is one that I don't think can be compromised on. And what we've seen is that the Democrats blinked, and they gave Bush another huge check, $100 billion, that allows him to conduct the war on his terms until at least the end of September. And we lost 127 Americans in Iraq in May. We're losing an average of 100 a month. And who wants to be accountable for 300, 400 Americans killed while political wrangling has taken place? And compromise is what led to that.
As we speak. We're speaking right now in Iraq.
Yeah.
So it frustrates me. And let me ask you just one quick thing. Do you think that the Democrats think that they're going to look bad if they just cut the funding? Or would they come out heroic? I mean, what is it? Oh, you know, it's going to come out in the media that these Democrats, they cut the funding so they don't support the troops again, you know?
Well, I just think the whole argument was falsely framed, and the Democrats fell into a trap that was contrived by the Republicans. And that was, it was all focused on the catchphrase of support or don't support the troops. And as we know, very little of that $100 billion actually flows to the troops or even to their benefit. A lot of that money is going to Halliburton and Khaki
right.
and Titan and Blackwater and other campaign contributors to the Republicans who are benefiting from the occupation of Iraq. And
right.
so if the Democrats had said, we're going to give you money for the troops, and that amounts to $22.6 billion. Okay? Here's your check. This is for the troops. The rest of it, you're going to have to find the money on your own because we don't support your policy. Ryan, thank you for the call, and thank you for serving our country under difficult circumstances. Jack in Oceanside, you're next here on the Peter B. It's the Tom Hartman Show, and I'm Peter B., and you're listening to my favorite radio station, KRXA 540.
Yes. You had a previous caller that was talking about bringing back the draft.
Right.
That subject always irritates me because there is a the 13th Amendment prohibits involuntary servitude, and I've felt that the draft always runs afoul of that issue, and yet it's never addressed. And now the government has a clever way to get around it: is if you're a male and you register for the Selective Service System when you turn 18, they consider you just volunteered for the draft, and even our income tax system is considered voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
And when you file your taxes, you have been considered to have just volunteered to pay your income taxes.
Okay. Well, I'm not up to speed on some of these nuances of the Constitution, Jack. And I do have mixed feelings about reinstating the draft, as I stated. So thanks for bringing that forward. I appreciate it. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment. A couple of lines open at 866-303-2270. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for joining me today on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
It's the Tom Hartman Program, and I'm Peter B. Collins. Glad you've joined us today. Tom will be back with you tomorrow, live from Dubrovnik, Croatia, where he is attending a conference this week. And then I'll be here again on Friday. Looking forward to that. We're taking your calls at 866-303-2270, and Robert in San Francisco is next. Robert, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, and would your initials be RCM?
Pardon?
Are your initials RCM?
No, they're not RCM. They're
okay. I thought maybe you were a guy I know, so you're not. Go right ahead, Robert.
No, but I did want to talk a little bit about the pretext for war, 9/11. The White House basically has controlled every investigation. Zelikow had a PhD in public relations and a PhD in marketing. And he decided what could be investigated in 9/11 and what could not be investigated. Controlled demolition was never investigated, and neither was the U.S. Air Force training exercises that suspiciously mirrored exactly what happened on 9/11, hijacked commercial airliners and planes crashing into buildings that Cheney was in charge of. Cheney and Rummy were running these air training exercises. Now,
well, Robert, I share your concern here. I do believe that Philip Zelikow was the handler dispatched by the White House to keep the 9/11 Commission, which it opposed all along, from going too deep in its investigation. And
well,
I want to direct people to the latest book by David Ray Griffin, a theologian, called Debunking 9/11 Debunking, because it takes a closer look at the explanations offered about his previous critiques of the 9/11 Commission's work, and it raises not only the questions that you've brought forward, but many, many others. And the bottom line is that we don't know the truth about what happened on 9/11, and we deserve to know as Americans, and I hope that someday, sooner than later, we will find out. Thank you for the call. Mike in Milwaukee, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter B.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I got a concern here as a Democrat. You know, I've been hearing lately on some of the radio shows and on this show, you know, Democrats calling and complaining about the vote on this Iraqi bill, knowing full well that we don't really have a veto-proof majority to really do the things that we want to do. We have a slim majority in the Senate, and we got a nice majority in the House. I think what we need to do as Democrats, instead of beating our elective officials over the head with this one vote here, is to make sure that when 08 comes around, we give ourselves the power that we need to really begin to shut this thing down. There was a bill put out there a while back by Mirtha where he wanted to cut off the funds to the Iraqi contractors, something that you had said a minute ago that caught my attention when you said, hey, here's your $20 billion for the troops, but if you want the money for those Iraqi contractors, you're going to have to find that money someplace else. But that bill got no play. I heard it a little bit on CNN, and I heard Mirtha talk about it a little bit on the Chris Matthews show, but nowhere else. I mean,
and I don't understand what happened to it either. I think it was a sensible follow-up proposal to the veto of the one with the limited benchmarks and timelines, and I don't understand why the Democrats didn't use that instead of sending the so-called clean bill before Memorial Day. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. Now to Hope in San Antonio, Texas. Hello, Hope. You're on the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Peter. I wanted to thank you for your comments and about the draft, but we're a military family, and I have to tell you, I kind of disagree with your position. While there's a certain understanding there, you know, most countries have required military service or cultural service of some kind, and when you take the position that I think you're taking, you end up sounding like most of the people in our administration who think we're good enough to serve, but they aren't.
Yeah. Well, I understand your point, and as I offered a kind of muddled position because I am conflicted on it. On the one hand, I would like to see the pain spread around fairly across the American public, not just to often lower-income groups and less skilled people who join the military to try to build their skills and build a future. And at the same time, I don't want to see another American sent to die in Iraq under any circumstances. So I do have ambivalent feelings about that. But the bottom line is I support universal service where 18-year-olds would be required to give a year or two of service to their country, where military service would be one option among others. And that's where I would like to see it go. Hope, thanks for calling. Jeff in Breckenridge, Colorado, you're next here on the Tom Hartman Program. Thanks for your call.
Thanks for taking it, Peter.
Oh, there you go.
Well, I'll drop it at that point.
Thank you.
I just had two things to say, one which is an opinion and one which is kind of a clarification. One is, I used to be a prosecutor in Chicago, although I was not a federal prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
But I know people who know Patrick Fitzgerald. I know a lot of people who have dealt with him, and although it was just sort of thrown out of speculation, I don't think Patrick Fitzgerald would do anything dishonorable in terms of trying to keep his job, doing what he's doing. He's got plenty of work where he is, and I think we'd probably be happier being back there. But
I don't mean to impugn his personal credibility. I'm only observing that there's far more that could have been explored in this whole case, and that he limited the investigation to Libby's lies to the investigators and the grand jury. And
well,
I would like to have seen him go much further. After all, he got permission from Acting Attorney General Comey to expand his investigation to the underlying issues of the leak, and yet he chose not to do that.
Well, I think he still can make that choice, and I think part of the thrust of his statements has been that he could not go further because of the obstruction that he was running into. But I'm not entirely familiar with the full brief that was given to him, so I don't want to go out on a limb.
Okay.
But the only other thing I wanted to say is that an old canard was said recently on the show, and that is this payment of income taxes is voluntary. Paying your income taxes, not voluntary.
I think you're right, and I'll take your counsel on that. Thank you very much, sir. I want to thank everybody who called today. Tom Hartman back here tomorrow by satellite from Croatia. I'll be with you on Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Visit my website, peterbcollins.com. Thanks for listening.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.